Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about pipelining. So last time we introduced sort of the basic idea of applying pipelining to something like this, our toy add queue processor, where we divide this into, in this case, four parts, and we execute parts of four different instructions all at the same time. And the hope is by doing this, we make our critical path shorter. So even though every instruction now takes four times as many cycles, we end up executing four of them at once. So we're effectively getting one instruction done a cycle as far as the throughput, which is what we really care about. How much work do we get done overall? And our cycle time is much shorter than in our single cycle processor because our critical path is from one pipeline register to another rather than going through the entire processor, going through both the instruction memory and the register file and the adder. Instead, our critical path only goes through one of those components because it's only what the slowest stage does. So any questions about anything from last time before we move on? But some more details and special cases in pipelining. Okay, so we're going to be implementing a pipeline processor in HCL. And our book describes parts of the pipeline processor in HCL, and I'm going to do that too. And as part of that, we're going to need a naming convention for registers. And the naming convention in our book, and that most likely you'll be using in the HCL assignments, is a little weird. So we have names for both sides of a register. So this register here stores the value being passed from fetch to decode for array. We're going to call the input side of it little f, f for fetch, underscore array, and the output side of it big D, underscore array, big D for decode. And that's going to be our general convention. The output of stages we're going to represent with a stage name and a lowercase letter, and the input, the stages from a register, we're going to input with an uppercase letter and the stage name. And you see that being repeated here, this dest D register, the side that comes from decode is named with a lowercase d, the side that goes to execute is named with an uppercase e, and so on. So this is the convention we'll be using throughout. So when I'm referring to f underscore, little f underscore array, I mean the output of fetch that goes to a register for array. And so on. So any questions? Fusion about this? Yeah.
You said capital is for the stage.
Yes, so capital is for the input to a stage, the output of the register. So we could have chosen different names. This is what our textbook uses, and this is what I'll use for consistency. So lowercase f is fetch, sends values here. Uppercase d is decode, receives values here, and so on. And part of the reason for this single letter prefix is just that this is how, for example, our HCL in the textbook and HCLRS work with respect to how you declare register banks. So you remember when you declared your PC, you had two letters you specified in the register declaration, and those were prefixes for the input and output signal of the PC register. And the same is going to be true when we make our pipeline registers. So to declare the registers that go between fetch and decode, with this naming convention, we declare register lowercase f from fetch uppercase d, and that gives us those names. We do the same thing for subsequent stages. So this means conveniently that within a stage, most of what you'll be doing is setting registers that are wires, which are correspond to registers that are prefixed with the letter of the stage. Because you're computing the stage's outputs to pipeline registers a lot of the time and getting its inputs from pipeline registers. And a lot of the work, besides declaring the pipeline registers, of translating from an unpipeline processor to a pipeline processor, is just going to be making things use these pipeline registers where you'd originally use some signals that would be similarly named, but be for the entire processor, not just a particular pipeline stage. So one half of the work is we want each stage to actually use these registers. Here, another half would be that, and this should be, that should be a, here should be, this should be a, the destiny. Sorry. So, and the other part of what you'll do is you'll need to define all the pipeline registers. So for our pipeline IQ processor, this is the pipeline registers I showed you. And you just define all of them. You have all your register banks. You can do this in various ways. You can like have them all declared up front and then write the stages separately. You can write them between the stages. It doesn't matter. They're just specifying what wires are there. It's not like there's no, the order things are executed is not the order in the file. But basically, when you're making a pipeline processor, the way I'd recommend doing it is you take your sequential processor, what you do for that, and you do this transformation where you say, what stage are we in? Let's change the things to use the pipeline register inputs and outputs for this stage. And let's also write the pipeline registers we need between the stages. So any questions on any of this? Okay, so you're going to need to do this for the full processor. So I have our intimidating picture of the full single cycle processor that you're eventually going to implement in homework in a week or so. And we want to translate this into our real pipeline processor. We don't just want to implement ADDQ, we want to implement this whole processor with pipeline. So the first thing I want to do here is identify the stages. And I showed a preview. So here is our full pipeline processor with stages. I just highlighted where each of our conceptual stages, which is what we've decided is the way we're going to divide our processor into pipeline stages, are. And we need to do one thing we did for the add processor, which is that we want signals to go from one stage to the next if it's for the same instruction. And we have some cases where that's not happening. In particular, we have this case where we're sending values in our single cycle processor directly from fetch to write back. And that's okay, because in a single cycle processor, all the values that we send get received in the same cycle. There's no buffers, pipeline registers, which decide what cycle they get received in later. But in our pipeline processor, we want the signal that comes from fetch to get to write back after going through the decode executed memory stage and taking the extra cycles that will take. So we're actually getting the values from the same instruction that we're sending these values to store here, as the ones we're sending the register numbers for. We need to have those two things be together. So what I'll do first is I'll fix this diagram to make sure I send each signal always goes to the next stage for the instruction. We never skip a step. So I'll send the register numbers through just like we did with the pipeline add processor. So they are being sent along with the other values for the instruction. So all the values for the instruction are all together. So this way we're passing everything for this instruction from fetch to decode, not from fetch to decode in some other places. Everything goes from decode to execute and not from decode to execute and sometimes decode to memory or something like that. And everything goes from execute to memory, not some things go from execute to memory and some go from execute to write back, because it's one instruction and the whole instruction needs to go to the next stage. So after I've just moved where wires were, I didn't actually change any of the functionality. And now that I've drawn it like this, I have my stages highlighted, and the basic thing we do with pipelining is we need to separate the stages with pipeline registers. The pipeline registers are going to hold the values we're working on and keep the values that are being computed by the previous stage from taking effect until we want them to, which is when that rising edge of the clock happens. So I just add a bunch of pipeline registers between every pair of stages. And every value which crosses needs to have space in those registers. Any questions on anything I did in this picture? Okay. So this is our basic process. This is how we're going to get our pipeline processor. And I'm not showing some control logic. And the control logic is going to have to deal with pipelining, and that's going to change the control logic a little bit. We'll talk about that in a bit. So our general rule here is that every pipeline stage is going to read the prior stage's output and send inputs to the next stage, except when we're deliberately sharing between instructions. So when we send values to the register, that's not to the next stage. That's into the register file. We want to do that, that's deliberate. We want to change memory, that's not to the pipeline register. And we want to do control flow. We want to do a jump. We're going to need to send the place we're jumping to across between stages that aren't consecutive. And that's normal because we expect a different instruction to use that address. So I mentioned we have control logic. So let's take one example of control logic that's going to be in our single cycle processor. So one of the control signals that I didn't draw on that picture of our single cycle processor are the ones which decide whether memory reads or writes. So if you know how the memory works in HCL, if you look it up, we have a signal called memread bit and memwrite bit. Two signals. Memread bit says, are we reading from memory? Memwrite bit says, are we writing to memory? And we need to set these signals based on the instruction we're running. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the I-code, and we're going to have a MUX in HCL, which looks at that I-code from the instruction memory and decides whether memory bit gets set to 0 or 1, and decides whether memwrite bit gets set to 0 or 1, based on whether the instruction reads from memory or writes to memory. So can I just use this MUX I'm going to write for my pipeline processor? So can I just use the same setup? Do I need to change this? I just have the I-code from the instruction memory. I check if the I-code is, say, mRemoveQ. And if so, I want to set the read bit to true. Is that going to work? So if people are shaking their head, anyone want to explain what's going to go wrong if I just leave this as is when I go to a pipeline processor? Yeah.
It's going to skip the middle stages, so it will be processing the data memory from two or three stages behind it at the instruction.
Yeah, so whatever instruction we're fetching is the one which is going to have us decide whether or not to read from memory. And that's not what we want to do. So we're going to be executing an add instruction, and a couple instructions after it is an mRemoveQ. We're going to look at that mRemoveQ instruction and decide, yeah, I'm read from memory, even though the add instruction doesn't want to do that. And the same thing is true for writing memory, which is considerably worse. So what we need to do instead is we need to somehow figure out not the I-code that comes from the instruction memory, but the I-code that would have come from the instruction memory when the current instruction was in fetch. And there's no place on the picture I showed you previously where that I-code is. We can't just look at the current instruction memory output and get it because it's not there anymore. There's a different instruction in that stage. So we need to have a register, which is going to be one of our pipeline registers, which holds the I-code, which tells us what is the instruction in the memory stage. So I can use the instruction in the memory stage to decide, am I reading memory, am I writing memory? And that ultimately has to come from the instruction memory, because that's where we read the I code. And it has to advance stage by stage by stage. So we're going to have a series of pipeline registers. So when we read from the instruction memory and fetch, we're going to send that to a pipeline register, the I code part, to a pipeline register between fetch and decode, then between decode and execute, then between execute and memory. So in the memory stage, we have the I code from the instruction memory when the current instruction wasn't fetched. Yes?
Didn't you say we're passing the entire instruction from stage to stage?
I didn't. So the question is, did I say we're passing the entire instruction from stage to stage? So we're passing all the data we need for the instruction. But this doesn't end up being necessarily the entire instruction. So we could indeed just pass the entire instruction. That would be sufficient. But we at least need to pass the I code. And passing the entire instruction, that'll pass the I code. That's enough. But it's not going to be, we're not going to look in the instruction memory if we're passing that. So this means that you're going to start out with code like this, where you check the I code. The I code comes from the instruction memory, and you compute something like memory bit. And instead, you're going to have code like this, where you take the I code from the instruction memory and fetch, pass it to a pipeline register, and that's used in decode. Decode passes it to execute through the pipeline register and so on, and eventually it gets into big M underscore I code, the pipeline register between execute and memory, and that's what we actually use for the memory bit mucks. And this pattern appears everywhere in our control logic. Anytime we need to make a decision where you're going to use I code in your single cycle processor, you're going to need to use the I code for the current pipeline stage that control logic is a part of. You want to make the ALU do things based on what instructions in execute, not what instruction you're currently fetching, and so on. So all over the place, we're going to use this I code we pass in these pipeline registers. So another thing that I mentioned you're going to need to do is you're going to need to figure out, well, what do I actually need to pass in pipeline registers? And one way you could do it is by trying to draw that picture I showed you and hoping you don't miss anything. I think that's fairly error prone and doesn't let you like build up the processor piece by piece. It, you don't want to actually try to write the entire processor and then debug it. That's not a viable strategy. You want to add instruction by instruction. So one way of reasoning about it is to use our textbook sort of line-by-line description of the instructions and look at what happens in each stage. And basically you say whenever you see a value that goes from one stage to another, you know that every pipeline register in between needs to have that value, because that's how it's going to get from fetch or wherever it starts to wherever it needs to be. So for example, here we get RA and RB in fetch. That's where they're assigned. And we use them later. We use them in decode, and we use RB in writeback. So since we use RB in writeback and we get it in fetch, every pair of pipeline registers in between needs to have it. Since we use it in decode, RA in decode, the pipeline registers between fetch and decode need to have RA. Otherwise, there's no way for it to get there. And we can keep applying this process to other values we see. So we know, oh, there's valet, and fetch, set, and decode, write, and execute must be in the pipeline registers in between. There's valet, set, and execute, write, and write back must be in all those pipeline registers in between. And you can just go through the instructions systematically, figure out what the pipeline registers need to be, how they need to be set. So it should be a fairly mechanical process to just write the pipeline processor instruction by instruction rather than trying to draw out the single cycle processor and divide the stages. So our textbook and we are going to make a little bit of a modification to this. And that's going to be that I'm going to set a signal called DESTY in decode rather than passing RB. This is not actually necessary. We can correctly implement the processor without doing this. But because RB and I code give the same exact information, but this is going to make implementation simpler in a bunch of ways. In particular, it's going to make dealing with hazards, which we'll talk about later today, much simpler. So you can apply the same process to other instructions. Look at where the instructions are used, figure out how values need to be passed around. And when you do this for all the instructions, you'll figure out everything that needs to be in the pipeline register and so on. And we can also see one example here. This is push, with why having guest D is helpful. Like, it will simplify our implementation a bit. Like, it's not necessary. Like, I could just pass the I code and know it's RSP. But by passing guest D like this, now my write back logic for push and add queue is basically the same where it wasn't before. So this is what we'll do, but it's not actually, you can implement your processor by just passing the I code and having a special case, but it's going to make things simpler to have the decode stage in addition to computing reading registers, compute the destination registers, and you pass them through the pipeline, even though it's not actually necessary to do that until write back. Okay, any questions on this idea of how we construct our pipeline processors before we move on to hazards, which you hopefully should understand this first? Okay, so now that we know how we make our pipeline processor, let's look at a big important situation that our pipeline processor that we've so far designed doesn't handle right. And that's, here's a nice sequence of adds. So we read the first add, we read from R8 and R9, and let's say they start out at 800 and 900. So we read 800 and 900, and then we compute the result is 1700, and we're gonna write that to R9. Then our next instruction reads from R9 and R8, so we're reading before we've written anything, so we read 900 and 800, because we haven't written 1700 yet, that happens later. And we compute 1700. And this is a problem. We hear, when we're reading 900 for R9, by the logic of the assembly, that should be 1700. Like, the previous add is supposed to have already happened. But the problem is that the write for it hasn't completed yet. It's waiting in the input to the register file. It's not happening until the next clock signal, it's rising edge. So this is what's known as a data hazard. A hazard is a case where our straightforward pipeline executes things wrong. And this is a case where it executes things wrong, we get the wrong answer. And what's happening here is that, you know, our ISA specification says that to execute these instructions, first you read R8 and R9, then you write R9, then you read R9 and R8, then you write R8. Our pipeline is doing things in a different order because of how our pipeline stages work. So we're reading an out-of-date value instead of what the instruction set specification says we're supposed to do. So this is the problem that this hazard is, and we need to come up with a fix for this. We're not going to be happy if our processor does this. If our processor violates the ISA, then it's an incorrect processor. So there's several solutions that we're going to talk about. So I'm going to first talk about the absolute simplest one. The simplest solution for our hardware manufacturers is to change the ISA. We can just say that add queues, well, I can just change my instruction set specification instead of the writing where I say what add queue does, instead of writing add queue computes the sum of the two registers and stores it in the result, I can write add queue computes the sum of these two registers, then two instructions later, it stores it in the result. I could write that as my ISA specification. And then the compiler would be responsible for doing something like adding knobs or otherwise putting other instructions in that hole. This is usually not something that people will be happy with. People do not like having to do this in their compilers. People don't like having to write assembly watching for this sort of problem. But it is a solution that some real architectures have done. Some real architectures have decided this is worth making the hardware simpler, even though it's making the compiler's job a lot harder and any assembly writer's job a lot harder, just because it simplifies the hardware. But usually people aren't happy with it and want the hardware to solve this problem without changing the instruction set to accommodate the hardware implementation. But this gives us an idea of a simple thing the hardware could do to deal with this, and that instead of manually inserting a knob, having the compiler do it, maybe the hardware can have some logic which does that for the compiler. You know, instead of the compiler doing it, the hardware is going to detect that the situation happened, and it's going to insert two knobs. It's going to run the program as if there were two knobs in between these instructions. So it's going to, instead of fetching the second add instruction, we're going to do a knob. And until we've done enough knobs that there's not going to be a problem. So this process is called stalling. We stop the execution of the program and just, we need to put something in the pipeline, so we put knobs in until we've waited long enough that the hazard isn't a problem anymore. Yes?
So is it the hardware logic that inserts these knobs, or is it like the and it puts it into the code, or is it like I don't get if it's like actually like in the machine code these knobs, or if like when it's running it'll see like this is happening, maybe there's a mux or something that then knows to have these knobs.
So the question is this in the machine code or not? So this is going to be something where, because the instruction set is defined based on what this particular machine code does, we can't change the machine code. So since that's not an option for the hardware, it's going to have to insert these knobs sort of virtually. When you run these instructions consecutively, it's going to run two knobs, but they aren't anywhere in the machine code itself. They're fetched from somewhere else in the hardware. And this is because, for example, if there's a jump instruction in the machine code, we need to have that still go to the same place, same PC. So we're going to have extra logic in the hardware to implement this stalling. So one piece of that logic is sometimes we don't want to change the program counter. Sometimes we're out on the add R9 R8 instruction that we need to wait for. We need to stay there while we're waiting for it to be ready to execute. And another thing is we need extra logic to sometimes, instead of sending the R9 R8 add instruction to the decode stage, we sometimes want to send a knob. We need extra logic to be able to insert that knob because it's not coming out of the instruction memory. We're going to have some constants that we can have a mux to send into those pipeline registers to say, don't read anything, don't write anything. So if we implement this strategy for our add queue case, we get something like this happening. We keep the PC the same for a while, and instead of sending the actual instruction through from fetch to decode, we send something saying do nothing. We send the register num values, for example, which is what we would want to send in a knob instruction. And this is our inserted two knobs. So some logic I don't draw in this picture makes it so these pipeline registers here have knobs instead of the actual instruction we fetched when we detect that there's going to be this conflict. That the instruction we just fetched doesn't work correctly with the instructions that are currently in the pipeline. It's not going to produce the right answer, because it's not going to read a value in time that's currently being changed. So another way of viewing what happens here, with this correction, we actually read the value after it's written. So another way of viewing what's happening here is, instead of by showing you what's in the pipeline registers, I can look at what instruction is currently executing in each stage. And this might be a clearer view about what's happening during stalling for some of you, it might not. So when we're stalling, here, the first instruction doesn't stall, But this conflicting instruction, we keep it in fetch, we keep it in fetch, then we decide to send it to the code. So the stalling is we keep it in fetch instead of sending it on, and we have to send something to the next stage, and that's where the not comes from. We have to put something in the pipeline registers. They're going to output a value on those wires, and we want that value to be not because we don't want to do anything. Any questions on this picture? So we have to have extra logic to decide I'm ready, not ready to go to the decode stage, or I am. And we're going to have to write that control logic when we need to do stall. I note that I showed you stalling sort of where we decide I can't fetch the next instruction. This might not be what real hardware does, or it might not be what you want to do. So another thing that you can do is you can say, okay, I fetched the instruction, I'm ready to read the registers, oh, I'm going to read the wrong value. And you can decide, I want to stop here. And this is another form of stalling. But here, we're stalling instead of deciding to stall during the fetch stage, we decide to stall during the decode stage. But the outcome is the same. It's just that instead of just fetching the same instruction again, we fetch the same instruction and keep the same stuff in decode. So we need some way of sending the values that are currently in decode back to do that. But that's just some extra logic we have, and we need something to make the fetch stage not advance either. But this is another thing you might do. The effect is equivalent, but it lets you make the decision that, hey, there's something wrong here at a later stage of the pipeline, and you might need to do this sometimes. It might not be efficient enough to figure this out during fetch, for example. So any questions on what's happening here? Okay, so here is a sequence of instructions. We have our four-stage pipeline here, fetch, decode, execute, write back. So given this, how many stalls do we need to actually execute this if we're resolving those data hazards with stalling? So figure this out and check with a neighbor. I strongly, strongly recommend solving all these problems by writing something down. I would get them wrong like 90% of the time if I don't, because I can't keep track of what's in what stage at the same time as something else without having it off by one error somewhere.
Thank you.
Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so apparently no one is willing to volunteer. So who thinks we need zero stalls? That this is a trick question, there are no actual data hazards here. How about one? Okay, a couple people. Two? Three? Okay, three or more, I should say. Okay, so most people think we need two. So let me talk about how I go about solving this sort of problem. So the first thing I know to look for is, where are the dependencies? Where do we write a value and then read it back? And we have two cases here. We have R9 here is read back here. R11 here is read back here. So those are the two cases, things in this code, which might cause data hazards that we need to stall for. So then I went to look at what happens when I run this code normally. What stage is everything going to be in at what time? And I can draw that picture this way. So I've written out a cycle number and what instructions in fetch, and so on. And if I did the natural thing here, I would get, I would have fetch here, decode here, execute here, and right back here. And that would mean here, where I have my first dependency, I would need to have a value read during decode, which is written at the end of write back. And that doesn't work, because the writing in write back happens at the end of write back. We need to read from during the middle of decode. So that doesn't work. Since that didn't work, I needed to stall. And that's why I wrote this X here and moved everything over. So that was the first stall I needed. And when I've done that stall, now value is written at the end of write back. It's ready during the middle of decode. So there's no problem. Then I look at my other dependency from R11 to R11. And because I already stalled once, it's fine. So I think the trickiness, which makes most people answer two, one of the ways you might get that is by assuming, well, I need to stall if I have write to R11 something, read from R11. So obviously there's two of those cases, I need to stall twice, but stalling once solves both of them because we're waiting, happening to delay both of the later instructions. Yes?
So if this processor had a memory stage, would you need two stalls then?
So if this processor had a memory stage, would I need two stalls? Yes. Yes, we need to do more stalling if we had a memory stage, even though nothing would be happening during the memory stage. So this also illustrates why I strongly recommend drawing out diagrams like this to figure this out, because you can't just look at the pairs of hazards independently and figure out what's going on, because some stalling changes what hazards you have still remain. So another thing we want to know is, okay, so our pipeline needs to stall. So we have to do this thing where we're not actually executing one instruction per cycle. Are we still getting significant benefit out of doing pipelining? If you remember, we already had problems with pipelining where we didn't take our cycle time and divide it in by the number of pipeline stages to get the new cycle time. So we weren't getting the ideal speed up, and this stalling is another reason why our pipeline is not going to get the ideal speed up. Even if our cycle time is four times faster, we're not executing every instruction effectively one cycle at a time. Some of our instructions basically take longer because we're stalling. So let's say I measured a program. I measured how much I needed to stall for that program, and I got these numbers. So one quantity we like to talk about when measuring the efficiency of a pipeline processor is the number of cycles per an instruction, which is how efficiently do we execute instructions. And in the ideal case, this is going to be one, that there's no hazards to deal with. We have one cycle instruction. Every cycle, we finish an instruction. But that's never going to be the case with a real processor. Sometimes, for some programs, at least, we're going to have cases where we need to stall, and so we're not finishing one instruction every cycle. So first exercise, if I tell you that this is what happens when I run a program, what is my cycles per instruction? What's the efficiency of my processor? So do the computation to figure this out. Give you a minute. Okay, someone want to tell me just, I don't need the number, but like what the formula looks like for doing this? For figuring out the number of cycles per instruction? Sure.
So I think it should be that you take the percent of each and multiply it by the cycle that would take for those instructions.
Okay.
The first one would be 0.01 times 5 cycles, because the one cycle that completes 4 cycles.
Okay, and you do that, and then you have another case, remaining case where you need to deal with the ones which don't stall. Okay, yeah, so that's a valid way of doing it. So the ones that stall 4 cycles take 5 cycles to complete. The ones that stall 3 cycles take 4 cycles to complete, and so on. So you just add those all up. I moved out the computation of the every instruction takes at least 1 cycle, but it's basically the same computation that you described. So we take an extra cycle for We take an extra cycle for 15%, we take two extra cycles for 10%, we take three extra cycles for 20%. That should be 0.02, and maybe this calculation is wrong because of it, and so on, and 0.01. And I'm not sure I wrote the right answer, but we'll decide whether or not. But you get, so the logic here is basically that everything takes one cycle. Everything takes at least one cycle. And for example, 10% take two extra. That's the sort of logic I'm using. So I just add up all those terms. And I apologize for not representing percents correctly as decimals. What? The answer is right, just the calculation formula is wrong. OK. Yeah?
Shouldn't the 1 have a weight of 0.8?
Shouldn't the 1 here have a weight of 0.8? Is that one? So.
The way I'm thinking about it is
so,
1% of the instructions takes 5 cycles.
So, OK. So there's two ways of thinking about this. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying every instruction takes one cycle. And I'm measuring how many extra cycles do some of the instructions take. So that one at the beginning is every instruction takes one cycle. And that's why I'm taking 0.15 times 1 and not 0.15 times 2. Because I'm saying 15% of the instructions take an extra cycle, not 15% of the instructions take two cycles. So I've compensated for it by adjusting what I multiply by later on. But both are valid ways of solving this. I just avoided computing how many instructions don't stall, but computing that is a perfectly fine way of doing this and will get you the right answer. Okay. So once you know this cycles per an instruction, so this is a nice efficiency number which says how good is our pipelining, how in sort of an abstract sense. If you want to actually know how much better the throughput is, you need to know what was the cycle time. Because when we did pipelining, we presumably made the clock cycle a lot shorter. So what our actual improvement is sort of how much shorter we made the cycle time. So that's the cost of uneven stages and things like that. And we additionally have to take into account how much worse things are because we had to do stalling. So we're taking extra cycles more than we would with our single cycle processor. So that's going to add a cost onto this. So if I want to figure out how much better is the throughput of our pipeline processor now, I can say, okay, so I'm taking an average of the cycles per instruction times the cycle time for every instruction now. So that, and I can compare that to the average I have with my single cycle processor, which is just the cycle time, because every instruction took exactly 1 cycle. And that will tell me my actual performance improvement. So one thing you notice here is that it depends on how often I need to stall, and that depends on what programs I write. So how much pipelining helps us depends on what programs we're running. So if I write programs which have data hazards between every pair of instructions, I'm going to get a whole lot less benefit from pipelining. Maybe my program will even be worse than on a single cycle processor. But the hope is that typical programs won't have enough of these to be a problem. So that's about the benefits of pipelining, given that we have to stall. So another thing we need to worry about is, how are we actually going to implement stalling? How do we make that logic happen? What does that actually look like? So I'm going to first do the mechanical part, and we'll go back to this later. So the mechanical part of stalling is that this is not magic, that you can make this happen. You could do this in HCL by hand. We'll have a shortcut, which we'll talk about later when we go to some other examples of where we need stalling. But stalling basically just means that we forward back the PC. Or in bubbling, which is what we'll call inserting NOPs, basically just means we have a MUX with an input in front of the pipeline register. So that's all we're doing. We just have to figure out what this control logic looks like. I'll talk about that later. But we just have this control signal which says, do I want to send the value back into the register or not? We have a mux to control whether we use the old or new value or whether we send this default value. So we're going to talk about what this looks like with a different case where we need to stall. So I'm going to talk about another type of scenario where we need to stall. So we talked about data hazards. And for data hazards, stalling helped us deal with problems where a register contained the wrong value. We were executing the right instructions at the right time, but the values read from the register were wrong. And they were wrong because we didn't write the new value yet. We needed to wait because things happened in the wrong order. So there's another case where things happen in the wrong order, which is much less subtle. And that's when we have something like a conditional jump. So I have a conditional jump here. I execute the jump, and next cycle, I need to decide what to fetch. And I don't actually know what I'm supposed to fetch, because I don't know whether the condition codes will be set or not, and I don't know that because the instruction up here, which is going to set the condition codes, hasn't run yet. It hasn't gotten even to the execute stage yet. We don't know what the values in the registers are. We certainly don't know what the computation is. And my condition code registers are set in the execute stage. So if I just read them to do this jump, I would be reading the wrong condition codes. I'd be reading the condition codes from several instructions back. And we could do the thing where we say, yeah, when you do a conditional jump, it's based on the condition codes as set three instructions ago. But that's not going to make people very happy. So we're going to need to do something to deal with this. And one thing we could do, is stall. We can wait until the condition codes get set. So we can have that extra logic where we feed back the old PC. We say, we're still working on the jump. We feed that back to the program counter. And we can also, send out a knob with that extra logic to the decode stage. And that's one solution to this conditional jump problem. And by doing that, we wait until we get to the execute stage and we actually write the condition codes so things can work properly. So we need to wait some time for SF and ZF in this case. Our condition codes will get updated. One way of doing that is by stalling. So if you remember the reading, we have something a little better we can do. But this is a working solution. Makes sense why we need to do this. So why we need to do something like this. We need to wait until the condition codes are set before we can actually know what instruction to run. So this thing in general is called a control hazard. So unlike a data hazard, we don't even know what instruction to run. So in a data hazard, we know what instruction to run. We're just waiting for data. In a control hazard, we don't even know what instruction to fetch. We can't even make any progress anymore in the program and know that it's actually doing the right thing. So that's another case where we could have a hazard we might want to resolve by stalling. So I'm going to talk about some other solutions to hazards and some other hazard cases. But before I do that, I'd like to look at what happens in each pipeline stage. Since this is important to understand why we have some hazards and not others. So one thing you might notice here is that we made this choice here that condition codes are set in execute. And maybe it seems like we should have made a different choice, but we kind of had to do that because we needed to decide to have condition codes be set somewhere. So we could have set them in write back, but that would make this worse, right? If we didn't have the condition codes until write back, we need to stall even longer. So that's the reason they're in execute. We can't do them before execute because we have to actually do the ALU computation to figure out what the condition codes need to be. So that's a reason why the condition codes are set in execute. And when we're organizing our pipeline, I'm gonna slightly revise what our pipeline stages do and add some things. So I mentioned that we do PC computation and fetch. As you can see, that we're not actually gonna do all PC computation because sometimes we need to stall and wait for something to happen. So most of the time we're computing the PC and fetch, sometimes we're gonna need to wait. We need to have something go through the pipeline first. In particular, conditional jump, that was a problem. We needed to wait for the condition codes to be around and to read them. But we have an even bigger problem for return. For return, we need to get the next instruction to run from the instruction memory, from the data memory. And the data memory might be used all the time before the return by other instructions. So we're actually going to need to send the return instruction all the way to the memory stage in order to know that the data memory is free for us to actually read the return address. And we're going to apply the same sort of policy to the condition codes, that we want to read the condition codes that were set immediately after the previous instruction. So we're going to read the condition codes, even for conditional jumps, in execute. Because we want to make sure that we're reading the condition codes immediately after they're set. So we're reading the condition codes that were just set before this instruction, not ones which are set after or earlier than that. And this policy of read something in the same stage you write it is an easy way to guarantee you don't read the wrong version, right? If you always read in the same stage you write, you never have data hazards, because you're always reading and writing in the order the program is written. So that's why we have this policy that we all do all our condition code reads and writes in execute. This way we never have to worry about reading the wrong version. But this means we need to stall for something like a jump. And we apply the same policy to memory. So we always read memory in the same stage where we write it. Data memory, that is. This means that we don't have to worry about writing a value to memory and not reading it, which we might have to do if we read them at different times. Here, if I wrote a value to memory in the previous instruction, that happens in the same stage where I read it, so it happens right after another, because we go instructions get to the memory stage in the order they're written in the program. We have a similar problem with the stat register. So I didn't talk explicitly about the stat register, but that's another thing that we need to update. And this needs to happen in the last stage. So what's going to happen if I wanted to update the stat register earlier? So usually, I figure out what the stat register should be in fetch. Why don't I write it earlier? What's the problem with doing that? So the stat register, you remember, is halt, for example, or invalid instruction. I figure that out during fetch. I don't actually want to write that earlier because I want to let all the other instructions complete. I didn't look around enough. So in order to let all the other instructions complete, I need to wait to write back. So all the other instructions update the registers. So when my processor halts and I look at the values of the registers, they'll all be what the registers would be when halt executes, just like our single cycle processor. Okay. So that's our updated pipeline. So one problem comes up here, which I mentioned, was that so for conditional jumps, we don't actually compute whether the jump should happen until execute, so we need to stall through because we don't know what to fetch next. But we're actually going to send the jump through the pipeline stages and have it do its work and execute to follow this convention that we read and write from the execute stage. And for return, we don't want to read from memory until the return can get to memory. So even though the return is conceptually done, once we've updated the PC, we're going to send the return instruction through the pipeline stages and have it get to the memory stage and then send that value back to the fetch stage. So for both of these instructions, we're going to send it through the pipeline and it's going to communicate back from either execute or memory where it does its work of reading condition codes or memory and tell the fetch stage what to do. We're not going to do all the work. All the PC computation is not all going to happen in fetch. So let's talk about return. So I'll start with conditional jumps. So for conditional jumps, we have our stall waiting case. So we set the condition codes. So we send the jump through the pipeline. And in the execute stage of jump, we actually process the condition codes and decide what to fetch. We do something like that. So that's going to be how we're going to process jump, conditional jumps. We're not going to do everything in fetch. We're going to send it through the pipeline, and we're going to send the signal backwards to the beginning, where we're waiting for the result to actually deal with the jump. And this ensures that we read in order. Similarly, for return, in the worst case, we need to worry about memory being written, the return address being written just before, so we can't read any earlier in general, even if we had some clever way of not worrying about instructions using the memory stage beforehand. In the worst case, we need to read right before. So we're going to send the return instruction through the pipeline. It's going to do nothing in decode. Well, it's going to read RSP in decode. It's going to do compute the new RSP and execute. And in memory, it's going to load the new address, which might have been stored in the previous cycle. And then we're going to send that back in order to fetch in the next cycle. So we read in memory, the next cycle, we send that back from the return instruction, so now we can fetch the new instruction. That makes sense? People look somewhat confused. So this is what stalling for a return looks like. So our stalling here, it's not really the case that we're running the return instruction over in fetch for multiple cycles. We're just sending it through and waiting for it to finish, is how you should think of stalling for something like return. And if we stall for conditional jump, that's what we're doing. So we're really stalling not because we don't know what to do next. It doesn't actually matter what instructions we fetch, but we just can't do anything. Yes?
Wait, so that means that for all other commands, normally you wait until execute, which is return.
So it depends. So usually, we just fetch the next instruction right away. So for return, we can't do that at all. For return, we can't do that until it finishes memory. For conditional jumps, we can't do that until it finishes execute. But the normal case is when we fetch the instruction, we know what the instruction to fetch next. So the normal case is just everything goes as normal. Like from call to ret, we didn't have to wait. So normally, there's no wait. So we need to implement this stall and this communication from other stages. So we take our sort of default PC update where we just add the instruction length. This is the thing which happens when we just go fetch an instruction, next cycle fetch the next instruction. And we need to add stuff to deal with the other cases. So sometimes we need to send the jump target or the return address, and that's going to be figured out from some future stage. So this is a wire which goes to another pipeline stage where we're communicating between instructions to say, what do we fetch next? And that's sometimes going to be your input. And sometimes we don't want to change anything. We're going to wait. And typically when we wait, we're going to just send back the current PC and fetch that again next, because we're still waiting to advance. We don't want to put random values in the PC. So this idea of what the logic looks like for that conditional jump with stalling and so on makes sense. So we just need to figure out how this control logic decides when we choose which option for the MUX based on what we want to go in each stage. So this is, I think, the most straightforward version of this logic. This is not what our textbook does. So our textbook rearranges this a little bit. So they, instead of having a PC, they have a predicted PC. So they replace the PC with something they call a predicted PC. And it's called a predicted PC because they don't always use it. They have this MUX here in front of the instruction memory. And sometimes they decide during the fetch stage that, hey, I'm going to send this jump target from another stage, or I'm going to send this return address from another stage. So this predicted PC register contains the result of incrementing to the next instruction, or stall, or keeping the same instruction number. And that's what we store in our register. And during the instructions running, we decide whether we use the value that is the actual normal next instruction or not. So that's the design, this type of design that our textbook uses. So they do part of the PC computation during the fetch, during the current fetch stage, and part during the previous stage. Whereas the straightforward thing, what you're doing in your single cycle processor, is you do all the computation of what instruction to run next before you set the PC register, and you just feed that to the instruction memory. So they are deciding, we're going to do most of the computation before we set the PC register, and we're going to do some of it afterwards. So we're going to compute the common case when we set the PC register, which is increment by the instruction length. And we're going to sometimes have to do something a little different, and we'll do that during the fetch stage. So I think they kind of assert that they needed to do this because of branch prediction and things like that. I don't think it's actually necessary, but this is what they've done, so this is how you're going to make sense of what the textbook is doing. So they've replaced the PC with this predicted PC, which is usually the address we're going to fetch, but sometimes you replace it with another value you got elsewhere in the pipeline, like where the jump instruction actually goes. So any questions on this? I'm sure this confusion will come up when we do the assignment again. Yeah?
Happens if you predict wrong.
So we'll talk about that later. So about what happens. So, but right now you could use this to implement where you stall still to avoid having that worry. So that means that our sort of PC update logic with this idea is that the PC, the input to the instruction memory, is going to be usually this register value, sometimes some other things, based on like whether the condition code said we take a branch or not. Okay, so this is a rearranging our textbook does. So given that, you might wonder, okay, so we're deciding, making part of the decision about what instruction to fetch during the fetch stage. So, and I figure out what instruction I need to run in case of return during the memory stage. So given that I know during the memory stage what instruction I'm fetching, what instruction I should fetch now, and I'm willing to put some logic before the instruction memory, why don't we just fetch the instruction immediately? Why do we wait an extra cycle? Why do we read from memory, next cycle instruction, actually fetch that, rather than doing it immediately? Why don't we just connect the output of this memory stage to the instruction memory? So any fears? So we could do this. So this would look like, so this is what things look like in the processor design our textbook has. So we, for return, we fetch the value from memory. We put it in this register file that goes between write back, goes to write back, and we send it into the instruction memory using that mux that's after the predicted PC register. So it would be correct as far as operation. The processor would work correctly if we just bypassed that extra pipeline register and did things a cycle earlier. This is fine because an instruction is not going from write back to fetch. We're just communicating between instructions and we're just waiting. We're not doing any work in fetch while we're waiting. So we could have done this. So what's the problem with this design? Why did the textbook authors avoid this? We know this would work. Why do they have that extra pipeline register there? So this is an efficiency problem. It's not a correctness problem. So this is very inefficient. And the problem is we need to think about cycle times and critical paths. So if we want to know how fast this processor is, we need to look at what is the worst case critical path. And if we have this, almost certainly, the critical path's going to be going out from the going through the data memory, then through the instruction memory, and then to increment to get to the next instruction address. That's going to be our new critical path. That's very, very long, because memories are pretty slow. And we're going through both of them. We don't want to do that. So that's why our textbook doesn't do that. Not because you couldn't, but because it would be very inefficient. That's a consideration for a lot of things in our pipeline. That we might, you might want to delay doing something that you could do because it will make your critical paths longer when you're talking about control logic and when you decide to compute branches and things like that. Because if we didn't care about the length of our critical path, we'd just use our single cycle processor. But we do, so we're going to need to worry about that and avoid doing things which make our critical path very long. So I mentioned we have these two decisions when we're doing this stalling logic, that we need to decide whether to stall or not, whether we keep the same PC value, like to wait for, until we're ready to run an instruction or finish an instruction or figure out what instruction to actually start next. And we also need to make this decision about whether we want to insert a NOP into the pipeline. And we have this sort of muxes to do that. This is how you could implement that. And you could certainly write this out by hand. You know how to do that in HCL, probably, because it's similar to what you're doing to like decide what register number do I write for this instruction that you're doing for your current homework assignment. But there's an extra piece of convenience in HCLRS, and that's described in our textbook, where these muxes are built in. You don't need to implement them. So every register bank has signals that control muxes for every single register in that register bank. So that let you do this stalling thing where you feed back the current value as the next value, or this what we call bubbling, inserting a NOP where you send the default values out instead of whatever value is being set as input. So these are for your convenience. We could have not had them, but then you'd have to have something for array, are we stalling? And if so, insert, the current value, are we bubbling? If so, and do that for RB again. Rather than having you write all that redundant code, we have one signal for all the registers declared in the bank. So, and this is a very common point of confusion in this class. And it's important to know to actually do the assignments later on. So first, I have this register bank, and I set the signals as such. Tell me what's the values in the question marks. So remember, a is the input, and big B, in this case, is the output, what the current value of the register is. So given this, figure out what the remaining values are and check with your neighbors. And we'll finish up on this. And most of our work when we need to implement something like stalling and bubbling is going to be just about setting these values correctly, which is why you need to understand that. Thank you. Okay, someone willing to just go through, well, I guess I'm short on time enough. So the biggest point of confusion here is that when we set the stall signal, that changes what the value is in the next cycle. When we set the bubble signal, that changes what the value is in the next cycle. So normally, we just read a value, the input, and copy it to the output. So that's our normal case here, is that we just copy the value directly. The stall signal overrides that when it's set in the same cycle, and the bubble signal also overrides that. So here, we don't copy the value because bubble is set, we use the default value. Yeah.
What happens if you set both stall and bubble?
So the question is, what happens if you set both stall and bubble? Don't do that. The textbook defines what it does. Our advice is just don't do it. It's not, you should figure out some other way of dealing with that.